Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of Focus. I'm Paul Nelson. We continue our look at how art heals as we chat with award-winning writer Wanda Coleman, a woman who benefited from government social programs that encouraged writing in Los Angeles after the Watts riots of 1965. Wanda despises the fact that mere entertainment has eclipsed art in America.
To me, this nation is upside down in terms of how it treats its artists in the fine arts across the board. The visual artists, those in the world of dance, those in the world of theater. And the ascension of Hollywood has eclipsed our truly wonderful artists.
Wanda Coleman has published many books of poetry, a novel, and was awarded the prestigious Lenore Marshall Poetry Award in 1999 for her book, Bathwater Wine. The visiting poet for Fall 2000 at the Northwest Spoken Word Lab in Auburn, Washington, this intense lady shares her views and work today on Focus. I hope you enjoy the program. It begins in just a moment. Thanks for tuning in. This program is made possible by Elaine Childs Gowell, author of Good Grief Rituals, Tools and Rituals for Healing Grief and Change, and Regression and Protection, a handbook for therapists and clients who are doing regressive work in touch. Information on the web at goodgriefrituals.com or at 206-781-0839. And by The Comfort Inn, 10 miles south of SeaTac Airport in Auburn, Washington, with in-room refrigerators and microwaves, an indoor heated pool, and business meeting space. For reservations, call Comfort Inn at 253-333-8888. We continue now with our chat with Wanda Coleman, the Fall 2000 visiting poet at the Northwest Spoken Word Lab in Auburn, Washington. Wanda is the author of many books of poetry, including Bathwater Wine, published by Black Sparrow Press, winner of the 1999 Lenore Marshall Poetry Award, author of the novel Mambo Hips and Make-Believe. Wanda has worked as a medical secretary, magazine editor, journalist, and scriptwriter. She's our guest today as we discuss the power of the word. There's a Billie Holiday poem that I've read on the air a couple of times now on the jazz program that I host, and just really nails it. I mean, it just really nails it. So why don't you start with that?
All right. What to do about Billie Holiday? The answer, and this is for Robert L. Greenfield. Now, once Billie Holiday starts jonesing around in your blood, and you're turning the colors of her moods, there's nothing you can do about the itch in your ears. And you must forget about those gold sequins that keep blitzing the inner screen of your eyeballs. Two, that thumping that starts at the back of your head and makes its way along your spine, rumbles around in your hip bones, tremors nearly dislocating them. Learn. You can cope with the aesthetic of it. Provided your spirit's strong with song, you can't go wrong. So what if you've gotten your belly full of star fruit? So what if even your Mojava heat can't rid you of those croony riffs encasing your feet in rhythm? So what if a manhole was opened in the main line to your soul? So what if noon after buzzy noontime you find Billie dancing in and out of your groin? And so what if she's bled you whiter than a camellia's ghost and blued your eyes into the sky above her pain? Don't fight her. Might as well fight spring. Don't rue the whiskey-stained dark that gave birth to her. Don't deny that doomed truth news of her final demise, or put a damper on your 78 groove, or silence those night-shine strummings on your heartstrings. So your throat's stung, deep smoked by those heady embers of Cafe Society torch? Swallow. Time to love it and live it again. Relax. Let Lady flow.
Oh, man. Oh, man. Now, you don't get that from the page. Let's get serious with that for a second.
Well, we're talking about two different art forms. Yes. We're talking about the art of writing, and then which is going to survive one hopes. And then we're talking about the art of performance.
And we're talking about the poetry of the future, which bridges this chasm between page poet and performance poet by having something that stands up on the page that other people can get the energy from and something that adds another dimension when it's read aloud. Is that accurate?
That's what I'm all about.
Well, that's why you're here. That's part of the reason why you're here. You know, some people write jazz poetry, and it's poems honoring jazz folk. Charles Simic writing, I should mention names, but Charles Simic writing about Monk is a jazz poem. However, there's people who take a whole new dimension to it, add a whole new dimension to it, those who really understand jazz and who embody jazz in the poetry that they write, whether it be about jazz music and jazz musicians or whether it not be about that. There's a complex rhythm that courses through all of your work, and jazz is one of your strong sources. And just the fact that what you share in common with the history of jazz is that integration of a European and African culture. So tell us the difference between jazz poetry and real jazz poetry.
Well, I think you summed it up well. There are those who appreciate from the outside, and who so they have an aesthetic appreciation of the form, and then there are those who become it, or who allow it to inhabit them, and then it speaks through them. I mean, that's usually that defines the difference between singers. Often, when they're approaching material, there are those who exist on the surface of a given art, and who are unable to really plumb the depths. And then there are those who are just simply as though they're vessels, like seeing Betty Carter sing, for example, as I was able to do while she was still living, and catch her. It was as though the voice inhabited her, and she was a temporary caretaker for this phenomena that came up through her and would zap the audience. I mean, it was incredible to see this woman perform live. You know, unfortunately, she's no longer with us, and so the world is deprived of her presence. But this woman was an incredible performer. And yet, the rooms would be filled and packed. When she'd play L.A., the rooms would be virtually empty. But they would be filled for someone who didn't have a tenth of her gift, which is one of the tragedies of that kind of magic. It's a magic that is yet to really be appreciated in our society.
Can you sense my teeth gritting when you talk about the, you know, it's that kind of feeling. And I guess what it comes down to is those who are real jazz poets and those who are not, what it comes down to is it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. I mean, that's one way of putting it. Some people have that swing, that essence. They know what jazz is about. I mean, if you tell a lot of jazz fans, quote unquote jazz fans, I have to be careful here.
You need those who do appreciate the form, though, even if they can't be it.
Right.
Because they're important too, and they do serve a role. And you need your fans. You need your love. Amiri Baraka is a wonderful soul, and I saw him read on the stage at Columbia University, and he had Philly Joe Jones with him and Archie Shepp. And this man wanted to be, he wanted to wail so bad. He was off, and he was gone. is the expression, you know, from the Beats.
A la Coltrane.
He was gone, absolutely. And he was so intense, so involved in the poem that he was reading that he was moving closer to the stage and actually fell from the stage. And the audience, you know, the brother sitting in the front, which included my husband, saw him coming, you know, towards the edge of the stage. And as he fell, they all reached out their arms and caught him and lifted him back up onto the stage, which was a wonderful moment. But he, at that point, he was making his transcendence. He was moving off of the page, and he was blowing. This was his axe. And even if he was tone deaf, that was not going to stop him. So he created this marvelous moment, was created out of that intense desire to reach for transcendence and to transcend.
Which was the essence of Coltrane.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, jazz and poetry have that something in common. To me, they're so related, but not everybody gets that.
Well, to make the leap in a way that's not secular, or a way that's non...
linear?
Well, to make that leap between the what's physical and on the page to the spiritual, whatever one perceives the spiritual realm to be, that seems to be something that man is constantly trying to do, whether we're talking about a rocket scientist or an astronomer, or whether we're talking about a financier, or whether we're, you know, there's the constant reach for the higher, that other dimension that gives our lives value. And so poets, of course, are not exempt often from wanting to reach that, although there are poets to whom this is of no value, that they're simply interested in here and now. But when that happens, and when that happens between you and the page, sometimes the mistake is to assume that you need some sort of substance to act as a bridge between you and it. And I think that's one of the values that jazz as a form has, although it too has been impacted by that kind of assumption, that here is a way to do it through excellence. You take care of your instrument, and it will take care of you.
Amen. Wanda Coleman is who we're talking to, the author of many books of poetry. Bathwater Wine on Black Sparrow Press is her latest, and she's our guest today. I'm Paul Nelson. Well, that gets us into another sort of distinction. There's a difference between people who write poetry and real poets, in your view.
Yes, and there are some of those who still pursue literary careers, which doesn't have really anything to do. There are people who are literary animals in the sense that they get over on their personality. That's their real poetry.
And we don't have to mention any names. That's absolutely fine. And I guess people who know what we're talking about can put two and two together and get a sense of that. But
well, that has its value to a limited extent. I call them literary. My word for it, my phrase for it, is the literary hustler. And you find hustlers everywhere, you know. And in the literary world, you have individuals who are getting an awful lot of steam off of very little in terms of their poetic gift. So they are cultural activists, more or less. And there are places for cultural activists, of course, and critics. But there is nothing, there is no substitute for the real poem, the real poet, the real artist. It's like, can you substitute do you want the article that criticizes Picasso on your wall, or do you want the Picasso on your wall?
Robert Hunter, Robert Hunter once said, you know, it's a difference between a postcard and a sunset. Right?
Absolutely.
There you go. All right, so we don't have to go very much further down that path, because I'll start bringing up words like parasite, and we don't need to go there.
No, let's stay here with the poetry.
All right, so very good. Well, let's talk about, you read a poem for Robert Duncan that was American Sonnet No. 12.
Uh-huh.
First, a little bit about the sonnets. It's not iambic pentameter rhyme scheme kind of sonnets.
Well, having fun. Some of them are. Some of them do rhyme. Some of them are. Sometimes I play with traditional forms and stay within. So I'm creating a tension within, a jazz-like tension and improvisation within the traditional form. And I will bust the rhyme or break the rhyme or find interesting ways to do something else with the meter and the rhyme.
Playing behind the beat, in a sense, right?
That's right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And they're quite fun. I'm having fun with myself as a writer when I write those. Often sometimes they're commentaries and satires. Other times they're just pure poems with my material at the heart of the idea. I enjoy doing them. They're my, jazzification, so to speak. I'm blowing my horn.
And Robert Duncan is a person who's I don't think really gets the credit that he deserves, but he's a big influence on you. And part of the San Francisco Renaissance of the mid-50s that helped pave the way for the Beat Generation.
Well, he received a lot of attention on the West Coast. So if you look at the dialogue, which is break, I think one of the nice things about our new information highway and becoming a digital world, one of the very positive things is that the discourse now between East and West is much more fluid. So you don't have it sort of breaks down the cliques, the barriers that really prevented a fruitful discourse. Which feeds the culture. I think it's a good thing.
A good development. What is it about Robert Duncan's work that you find especially endearing?
His lyricism, probably, and his imagery. There are echoes of him from time to time in my work, like the word gerfalcon, for example, in one of his poems, which is a lovely word. He had a sense of the loveliness of language, and I liked that about his work. His lyrical mood, which I enjoy imitating. In other words, I'm doing a riff on. So if I want to do a certain riff on a poet, I'll do it on Amiri Baraka also. I do riffs on some of his poems. There are certain poets that I really like. And in my next manuscript, as a matter of fact, I have at the core of it a mock anthology in which I do riffs on many different American poets in the canon, and where I'm complimenting, commenting upon, honoring, and doing all these various takes on a spectrum of poets in my rogue anthology.
There's so many more questions I have, but you have your book open, so why don't we let you read a little bit?
For the sake of the cool, the magician stumbles in after a long jam, peeling notes off the walls. He washes his dry, so long ago hands, settles in for a sleep till 2 afternoon. Just another escapade in rayon, prelude to a shower and the joys of happy hour. To mute or not mute? Hush now. Such tough, satisfying labor to make 'em sing. Shades of bliss, molten notes, star hot, stalking inspired ears, make 'em sing. Song violent in the blood, that soul stomp of leather to the wood, hand meeting hand to make 'em sing. For the sake of the cool, to be obvious must be forcedly understated, and what has snapped, held together by strong clams until a needle and thread can be applied. For the sake of the cool, stupid risks must be taken, but risks nevertheless. Things uttered and dismissed and reconsidered and mitigated until terms are defined and mutually understood. For the sake of the cool, no one's hero goes to jail for trifling things. And indirectly, jazz allows men to worship men without onus. Spirit, dig, coon, holla, hallelujah, riffs all rush and muddy. But the women must fend for themselves and make 'em sing for the sake of.
Wanda Coleman reading from Bath, Water, Wine, For the Sake of the Cool. Wow. Ethelbert Miller, who's a mutual friend, says that American poets are all children of Walt Whitman. And you would consider yourself in that lineage.
Oh, absolutely.
Tell us why.
Well, I think because I'm a part of the chorus that's singing America. You know, that song of ourselves. Whitman's, I'm a child of Whitman in a pragmatic sense, that poetry, poets are not businessmen, but we're forced often in a position to represent ourselves in that arena, to dicker for the check, to find ways of, new ways of patronage to support what we do. Filling out grantsmanship applications after application, sitting on panels, entering the university system, teaching, doing all of these things that are sometimes antithetical to who we really are. Because unlike, to me, this nation is upside down in terms of how it treats its artists in the fine arts across the board. The visual artists, those in the world of dance, those in the world of theater. And the ascension of Hollywood has eclipsed our truly wonderful artists. I mean, it's to me it's a tragedy that jazz has left the club, the venues where it was born, and is now to be found in the museums, an artifact. And I think that's a tragedy. And that because music has been devalued in our school systems across the nation, we don't have those ears that are so necessary to perpetuate the love and appreciation of that excellent, that incredible musicianship. Well, that's true of poetry as well. Poetry is still looked at as something that's not necessary, that's a luxury, that's not a vital part of life. And yet, there are so many, you know, it's so easy to meet someone who will shyly open a drawer and pull out a manuscript and show you that they write poetry. But poets are of no monetary value and therefore are of no value at all.
What is the value that poetry and art bring to a society?
It makes, it's man's highest dialogue with himself. It enriches, it deepens life. That's something it shares with religious belief. It gives you a reason to go on.
And we certainly need a few of those in this society the way it's going. And you certainly provide a lot of that light just by yourself. You're like a one-woman power station, let me tell you. It's been amazing to have you in town. I hope that there's a way that we can bring you back very, very soon. And I wish you continued success, happiness, and prosperity with your work in life.
Thank you, Paul. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, that's the idea. if it ain't fun, why are you doing it? You know, that's part of the way we do things around here. Wanda Coleman has been our guest, and one of her most recent book of poetry is Bath, Water, Wine. You can find that published by Black Sparrow Press. More information about Wanda is available on the web, and you can find our website at www.nporia.org. That's INPERIA.org.